Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, March 30th, 2023. Already a third of the way through this year and moving quickly. A lot of topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about the perfect place, or is there a perfect place? It used to be back in the early Planet X days, back, say, in the late 90s, early 2000s. The big topic was, in fact, people were selling maps online or whatever means for safe areas. And so this was not like safe rooms where you have at colleges where kids can go and be safe from other thoughts. This would be like, you know, examining all of the difficulties that could occur in your life on planet Earth and trying to find that perfect place, that Shangri-La. Shangri-La, that's the name in the mythical place in Indian mythology and lore that is perfect. Everything is perfect. Everybody is wonderful. Nothing, you know, everybody has plenty. And it's just a human, literally, Shangri-La. And so people would actually sell maps. But you can also talk about the places that you really would not want to be. And there's some very big reasons. You know, and this depends on taste. Like, there are some people that just cannot get enough of New York City. And then there are people like myself that I've been in New York City and did not impress me at all. You see the people, there's a few spots, if you got enough money, that is just swell. And that's the ticket with, you know, with any big city. I don't think New York has it much going for it anymore. But back in the day, you know, when it was a bustling city, and, you know, a lot of people wanted to go there. But anyway, what I'm going to try and do tonight, though, is not just talk about the place that's the perfect place to be, but just in terms of weather, or you might even call it climate. What kind of time frame is there through, you know, during the year, the good times of year and bad times of year? And of course, I grew up in a place called Minnesota, which oddly enough has the biggest extreme range of temperatures of any place on planet Earth. It gets, and this includes places like Alaska, includes places like, it has both extremes. And just to give you an idea, if you took a map of the North American continent and cut it out on a piece of, like, let's say you drew it on a piece of plywood, the North American continent, and you found the point where that North American continent would balance, that's Minnesota. Oddly enough, it has two international seaports, Duluth, which goes out the Great Lakes, and it is an international seaport. It has the locks at Sault Ste. Marie as it goes between Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. But anyway, big ships come in there, ocean-going vessels, into the Duluth, and Superior is in Wisconsin side, and Duluth is in the Minnesota side, but it's that point down there of Lake Superior. So that's one international harbor, and then the Minneapolis-St. Paul have a river called the Mississippi River that divides the entire country, and it is an international port also. And so anyway, you don't have the big ships coming in there, but you have barge systems that go up and down the river carrying goods from international domains. And of course, New Orleans, as you get down to the Delta, past Memphis and down to the New Orleans port, the New Orleans port on the Mississippi River is the fifth largest in terms of activity, the fifth largest port in the world. And now some people might go, huh, you know, that's kind of shocking. But Minnesota connects to that by a series of barges. So Minnesota being the centralmost place in the North American continent, has two ocean-going seaports, which is, and it borders Canada. But anyway, in terms of temperature, the record cold of the United States is set there frequently. A few years ago, I think it even was reset down to like 65 or 68 below zero. And I've been in that kind of weather. I've been on the top of a mountain skiing in Minnesota. Yes, there is mountain skiing in Minnesota. You might be surprised. Most of it's flat. But anyway, with a 40-mile-an-hour wind blowing in 40 below zero, skiing, and if you have the right equipment on, it's like being on the moon. You don't even know it. You're nice and warm, etc. But so 65 below is the lowest temperature, and I think Minnesota's high record temperature is like 108, 106, somewhere in that range anyway. So you have in excess of 170 degrees temperature swing between winter and summer, and that is the most extreme place of any place on Earth. Most places average, you know, maybe 50 degrees or something like that, but 170 degrees is hard to beat. So they're the winters. But people find quality of life there. There's an old saying that when I was a kid, we had a saying that the cold keeps the riffraff out. And so you literally cannot live there unless you really got your stuff together. It's just not going to happen. And so anyway, in spite of the variation in weather, and by the way, the corn grows very well. Minnesota is a corn state. And the corn does very well in August. In fact, I was once on a friend's farm, actually down in Iowa, visiting in the heat of August, late August, where it's just, you know, 100 degrees at night, and you just sit there and sweat the beads. When we were kids, of course, we had no air conditioning. But this friend of mine says, "Hey, listen to that." And so we're sitting there out on the steps out behind this farmhouse, and you could hear this noise. It was kind of like unlike anything you've ever heard before, kind of a rustling noise, but what it was the corn growing. The corn was growing so fast that it actually made a sound. And so anyway, what I'm going to do here is go through some of these states and see if we can find a place in the United States that has the perfect climate. And so let me start out by defining the perfect climate to begin with. It would be a place that would have year-round temperatures with minimal temperature swing. And, of course, what's kind of fun is the change of the seasons, where you have fall, you have colors, the leaves have a beautiful color, and it's a very nice time of year. All the bugs are gone. It's cool nights, usually drier than, so it can be rainy. But usually fall is a drier time of year. Springtime is more rainy. But at least a place that would be ideal would have some kind of seasonal change and even get a little bit of dusting of winter. But, you know, the Minnesota winters are like 6 months long. When it hits in late October, early November, that's what it's going to be like until sometime late March, maybe April, and even into May, where you could have severe winter, depending on where you are in the state. And then all of a sudden it changes. And, okay, just to back up a little bit, why is there a temperature difference between the season? And it simply comes down to actually two factors. On a daily basis, it's from what direction is the wind blowing? If the wind's blowing from the south, it's warm. If the wind is blowing from the north, it's cold. In fact, there's a joke about North Dakota, that North Dakota, the only thing between North Dakota and the North Pole is a barbed wire fence. But anyway, back to the other, and this goes for other Midwest states also. But it just comes down to the idea that amount of sunlight that comes in per day. And if you say go up to the Canadian border or up into Canada, now you're dealing with the winter time where you only have 6 hours of daylight, and boom, it's dark. So you go to work in the morning, it's dark. You come at home at night after work, it's dark. you know, and then you spend your day in an office building unless you're actually working outside. But most construction, a lot of it shuts down in the wintertime just because it's kind of hard to deal with cement and other things, although they're doing that, but still it's not as active. But it simply comes down to the amount of sunlight that you get every day. So in the summertime, the opposite thing is happening, where you have long days, 16 hours of sunlight, and then it's very short evening. So the earth just doesn't have time to cool off. And just every day you get pumped hot air, hot air, hot air, and hot air. Okay, so what would be the ideal climate? And so I would say, where you have seasons, you have summer that's not so hot, you know, doesn't get up to maybe over 85, and then the winter time does not get down in general to more than like 50, let's say. But you have those days where you have some snow, and it's kind of fun. Everybody can make a snowman, some snow angels, and you're good to go. You're good for the winter. But there's a very funny song, and it's this Mexican guy, and he comes to Minnesota, and he's so happy. The first day it snows, he's ecstatic. He's out there making snow angels, and he just you can't believe how happy he is that that it's snowing. And so anyway, the song goes on, and as he progresses through winter, you know, his car breaks down, it doesn't work, the battery dies, on. So he just goes through the winter, and by the time spring comes, he flies to Acapulco. And so, I mean, after 1 year, he's had enough of winter. Anyway, but back to the states. So let's look at some of the other states. Do they have perfect climate, or is it a place where you'd want to go? And really, the continental United States, let's just put it this way, whether you go from Florida to Texas, California, go north to Oregon and Washington State, they are not too bad because they have the warmth of the Pacific Ocean there to moderate the winter, even though they're far north. They're as far north as Minnesota. They have that moderation from the Pacific Ocean. So they might qualify as a pretty good climate. A lot of people live there. But they've been invaded by Californians and have pretty much ruined those states. So people are leaving in droves. I know people who have left Oregon and Washington State because they just can't manage the insanity. But here's the deal. You probably don't have any place that has excellent climate year-round, and that's why you have this term called snowbirds, where you have people that go up to the northern states in the summertime to benefit from the nice summer days and et cetera when it's cooler, and then they go to south, any place south. It could be Arizona or Texas or New Mexico or Florida. Those are the big states. Arizona and Florida are the big states for the snowbirds. Snowbirds meaning that they migrate during the winter. But let's take a look at Arizona. You know, 105 in the summertime is not uncommon. And Nevada, the same thing, California, out in the desert away from the ocean, it gets pretty steamy hot. San Diego, a place I've spent a little bit of time in, is one of the nicer climates, or Southern California, L.A., not too bad. But let's take a look at, say, Hawaii, for example. You have probably what many people would consider to be the ideal climate, but it can get hot in the summertime, and it can get actually chilly in the wintertime, depending on where you are, because if you go up into the mountains, say up out of Honolulu in the mountains, it can be rather chilly there. But at any rate, the other thing about Hawaii is it is prone to having hurricanes, except they do say that the Big Island has never had a hurricane, and there's a reason for that. That's because the big volcano there, the Mauna Loa volcano, has an electrical discharge to the vertical electric field. It's pretty much constant. So when the hurricanes come in, and I have seen this happen, when the hurricanes come in, they get close enough and they short circuit that circuit that's connecting Mauna Loa electrically to the ionosphere. It grabs the circuit that's driving the hurricane and it pulls it in and snuffs out the hurricane. A very interesting effect. And so, at any rate, the Hawaii might be considered to have one of the best climates. And then also you get fall if you just go up into the mountains. Florida, though, in the summertime, there's I would imagine right now, the Florida has one of the best climates considered by Floridians to be paradise in the wintertime. But around March, things start to warm up. And then early June, of course, you get the high humidity, you get the daily rains, you get the 100-degree weather with 100-degree or 100% humidity, and it turns it into a sauna, an inescapable sauna. The other thing that happens is the sargassum moss. It's like this grass moss stuff that grows out in the ocean. Is really a natural phenomenon, and it has many benefits as far as the fish life, and it will kill some fish because of the hydrogen sulfide gas that it gives off. But it is a benefit because a lot of critters, let's just sea critters, use it for shade, like little turtles are benefiting from it. Jellyfish can attach to it and grow there. So there's some natural benefits that occur from this moss. But when it comes in close to shore, it gives off a gas called hydrogen sulfide, and it can be very noxious. It's not a deathly poisonous gas, but it can be definitely noxious, to the point where people, it can cause health problems, variable health problems, depending on the person. Okay, so moving on to Arizona. Of course, Arizona in the summertime is
a blazing hot, you know, fry an egg on the sidewalk type of thing, but it's dry, so it's not that uncomfortable sauna-like heat that you would get in Florida. But I lived in Louisiana for a number of years when I was getting my physics degree, my advanced physics degree, from Tulane University. And so I lived right off of the university, which is up at the end of St. Charles Avenue. And so, and I lived there without air conditioning. I did just fine. I rode my bicycle. I went my bike to work, but of course, the physics department was air conditioned, and of course, most people lived in air conditioning there. So I mean, I just adapted. But when I went home, or say I'd jump in my little VW car, my bug, it was the original VW. His little car, you know, and which I did all my own mechanic work on and everything, as most VW owners did in those days, because you had to adjust these gaps that had to be adjusted regularly so it would run properly. But or I'd go down into the bayous Friday afternoon, get out of my research lab, jump in the car and go down to the bayou. And the Cajuns, where the shrimp boats would be coming in, the other types of fishing boats, where they got every type of seafood on the planet out of the delta down there. And they would be pouring this into big pots, and the women were cooking and cleaning the catch, etc. And there was music, the little local groups had music going on, and I don't think you could describe this unless it was like a Tennessee Ford novel to understand really what it was like. But it was just an amazingly fun time. Everybody was happy. Everybody was you know, having a good time. But a very simple life, which brings me up to maybe the main point of this thing. It's not so much the temperature or the climate, which is the interesting thing, because people, you wonder why people live where they live. It's probably because they were born there. They were acclimated as kids and grew up there. And the other biggest factor is that their family is there. All, you know, in the modern world, a lot of family members move away. And back in the day, that was still very common, where people grew up, they worked locally, they met the girl of their dreams locally, got married, had kids, you know, went to high school. A lot of my friends got married out of high school and had families and lived there in the little town, which sometimes I wish I would have done things like that, just to have a very simple life. But I think I had some other destinies along the way. But anyway, the point is that where your family is, you can live with climates, whether it's the coldest Minnesota winter or the hottest, muggiest Florida or Louisiana summertime heat. If your family is there, then all of the other factors seem to go away. So this brings up a couple other topics here. Climate control. Now, they've gotten to the point where they can control weather systems. And in other words, these are low-pressure cells, and they can move them around. And by the way, a hurricane is nothing more than a low-pressure cell. But the way they do it, of course, is with laser satellites. But by controlling low-pressure cells, they can control the wind direction and therefore stymie the water production coming from a certain body of water that, for example, would give California rain on a regular basis. And they could control that to the point where they had extended drought, and then all of a sudden change it to the point where they have massive flooding. And so climate control is going on. And then, of course, you have a hurricane that hits a certain area, and they go, all the weathermen that are working for the National Weather, the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which we call the National Weather Service, all these little minions running around saying, oh, it's due to global warming, when there's not an ounce of real science involved there, since there are many, many factors that are involved in hurricane production and sustenance. And, of course, none of them are correct. And as with many systems of disinformation, the people giving out the disinformation don't even know they're doing it. They think they're smart. Weathermen, what they are, weather readers. They don't tell you the news because they're smart. They read it off of a prompter, and that's what they're good at. Okay, so anyway, I believe last week I talked about Cyclone Freddy coming in off of the Indian Ocean and devastating, going inland 500 miles, being reformed. So it's at the point now where they can control hurricanes and pretty much at will. If they go, Cyclone Freddy headed across Madagascar, it should have lost most of its energy and pretty much died out there, but it didn't. It regained energy and went into the countries in Eastern Africa. And I went through an extensive discussion of this last week. So listen to that show for more information. But it's a new generation of storm on parallel strength. And of course, the CNN mouthpieces are going to immediately pound the global climate change myth. And, of course, the leaders of these little puppet countries with their little puppet governments, and, of course, with wonderful people living there, but their puppet governments are completely corrupt, saying, yes, all of the first world countries that are causing this tremendous storm activity because of global climate change must give us reparation money. That's what it's all about. And it's a divide and conquer, Marxist technique, where they get the rich against the poor, the the wealthy countries against the poor countries, when in fact it's the bankers that have caused this entire system of poverty around the world. Okay, so what are some of the effects of man-manipulated hurricanes that are going to be more intense, can go farther inland? And I talked about a piece done by CNN Weather, which of course is a complete mouthpiece for the chain of command going up would be the National Weather Service, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a government agency, then under the CIA, which is under the World Bank. And of course, this is all part of the global climate change agenda to control every aspect of the world, including food and water and the air and energy. But imagine this, that all of a sudden now they can manipulate storms to the point that they can go very far inland. And as very specifically noted in this CNN hit piece, the damage that can be done by hurricanes now is much more extensive and can hit areas where hurricanes never caused damage before. And we actually have seen this happening. There was a hurricane that came into Louisiana, Texas region. There's a lot of rice growing there. And it happened exactly at the rice harvest season last year, causing a big dip in the world production of rice. And so this is the end effect. But imagine you're in the insurance business. All of a sudden, you can take a loss of, say, $1 billion in a hurricane that hits some area, knowing that you're going to turn around and now say, oh, these hurricanes are bigger, they're hitting more places. And that's one of the very specific things they actually talked about, was the doubling or tripling of number of houses in the United States that would be susceptible to hurricane damage in the future because of this climate change. And so anyway, this is all coupled together where they make the climate control, climate change case for increased hurricane strength, which of course is totally bogus. And then the insurance company, which they also run and operate, takes a loss. Okay, but that's paid for by, it's not really a loss. It's kind of like, let's call it an investment, like the pharmaceutical companies that give little kids 169 shots before they're age 16 and then have an entire lifetime of selling pharmaceuticals to these kids as they grow up, or their parents, etc., where you have totally dysfunctional kids because of the amount of vaccinations they've had to withstand. It's the same thing. It's the old protection racket. And creating, like the old protection racket, you know, a guy's got a shop and he's been there, you know, like little shop in New York City selling something. And the boys come in one night and they go, Pops, you know, things are getting bad around here. You really need some protection. And the guy goes, well, you know, I never had any protection before. I'm doing just fine. I don't really think I need your protection. So that night the boys come in and bust the place up, and they come back the next morning and they say, Pop, doggone, you know, if you had our protection, this wouldn't have happened. You know, and so we'll be back at 3 this afternoon to pick up your donation for our protection. And so they force people by causing the problem, they force people to pay them. It's the old protection racket. So that's what this is. It's a new twist by your friendly local National Weather Service, along, of course, coupled with, they're just the messenger. They're the guys that go in and tell you, and like the CNN hit piece, that they're the ones that go in and tell you that you need their protection. And this, and the insurance is the biggest protection racket of all. Where you pay them, they always make a lot of money. By the way, if you're in doubt about this, go into any downtown area of any city in the country. The biggest building will be the city, all the city government buildings. So the city government is the biggest business in town. The second biggest set of buildings would belong to the insurance companies. Because what do? They invest in real estate. They invest in other things. So that when you pay your money, hopefully their losses at any given time will be less. But in the time they're waiting for losses to occur, they're investing the money mainly into real estate and other things which have a good return on investment, a monthly return. So the insurance companies get big very quickly and make a lot of money. And then if they can throw in the protection racket deal, like with hurricanes, and all of a sudden they have CNN saying it, they have the actuaries who work for the insurance companies making calculations and saying, okay, and by the way, this is the way home insurance works, if you're not familiar with this. If you live in a state like North Dakota, where you're not expecting hurricanes, then you don't have an issue. You do not have a hurricane rider on your policy. It just wouldn't make sense. But if you're living in a state like Florida, which has hurricanes, then you have a hurricane rider on your policy. And then you have to pay more for hurricane insurance. And there are people in the big, devastating hurricane just all the time down there that don't have insurance because they can't afford it. Or maybe they just don't think that their house is going to blow away when the hurricane comes. But at any rate, it's a way of the insurance companies covering their losses, and the actuaries figure out the probability and statistics, etc., of a hurricane damaging a said house. But what if all of a sudden, because of climate change, the big boogeyman climate change comes in, and all of a sudden you have 2 to 3 times the number of houses which are now susceptible to hurricanes, allegedly. And so, oh, doggone it, we got to have the, you got to pay us, pops, or we're going to come in and the big bad wolf is going to blow your house down. It's the old protection racket, just like it always used to be back in the good old days, downtown Chicago or downtown New York. But now it's white collar protection racket. That's what the government does. That's what COVID is all about. That's what mass shooting, take your guns away, is all about. It's the protection racket. The government is going to protect you. And education. Education is a racket designed to make you think that you have to send your kids to some public school and learn the indoctrination. Okay, so I'm not going to go there tonight. But anyway, enough said about this. The next topic I want to talk about is venture capital. We have the SVB bank failure, along with a number of other banks. And what really is going on here? And so let me just describe, because I've been down the road with venture capitalists. I have actually, I've been in the, right in the venture capitalist building office. And I started at a very young age when I was out in California looking for funding for my aerospace projects, and I was, basically brought into fairly high-level venture capital groups. And they were doing mainly military-industrial complex investments. And so that's where I got my first taste of the families that run the world. Operate a lot of them through these venture capital groups, and that's not all they do. They do a lot of other things. But when I went into these offices, I would see these young guys driving, European sports cars, million-dollar cars, and, with a lot of money, beautiful wives, the whole nine yards. And I'm going, where did I went to the wrong college. I didn't, I must have had the wrong education or something. Where did these guys go to get a degree where they got these jobs? Well, they didn't get a degree to get these jobs. It was their family. Now, these are the families involved in the military-industrial complex. And by the way, all of this chatter about the Hunter Biden laptop, and that he's making deals and things like this, he's the tip of the iceberg. And that is the biggest con story of all time,
Because as they drag that out, as they use him as the poster child for, you know, cutting deals with foreign governments, etc., that's just one of the people in hundreds of families that are operating, making big amounts of money, cutting deals behind the scenes. And they're doing it because their parents have already established a track record of being in government and getting the money out of government and moving it into their own pockets. The Nancy Pelosi husband deal, where he has this stellar record, better than any investment corporation, of making investments, just happens to be in the things that his wife is voting on in Congress. Ha! What a good deal, if you can get it. But at any rate, the venture capitalist groups are bound to fail, and this is what I learned. And by the way, they are just ripoff agents, and their goal is really to destroy the companies that they invest in. And the reason they want to destroy them is because then they can buy them for pennies on the dollars. I mean, J.P. Morgan had that down back in the early 1900s. The Reserve Bank, Federal Reserve Bank, and then the Reserve Mining. He had all these things called reserve. And so, anyway, he was the component of the world bankers in the United States. Chase and Morgan and all those guys were bankers. And Morgan was the guy that funded Tesla and then pulled the rug out from under him. These guys were famous for this. There's a story about J.P. Morgan. The Mesabi brothers, there were these two guys, and they were from, like, I forget, from European country, and they knew how to find iron ore deposits. So they're up in northern, what is now northern Minnesota, and discovered the Mesabi Range, it's called, and there's many different aspects to this, but it's where the iron ore came bubbling up through the surface and created these veins of iron ore. Up along, then they stretch off in the northeasterly direction. And they discovered these and realized the massive amount of iron ore that was in these, locked in the ground there. So they were developing a train system, and they brought in Chinese workers for cheap labor. And they were making a train from the Bemidji mines near Bemidji, Minnesota, where the Mesabi Range is, over to Lake Superior, where they were going to have a port facility, and then they were going to haul the iron ore down to Cleveland and other places in mainly Ohio through the Great Lakes, where it would be then smelted and made into steel and, you know, have that whole production. But the Mesabi brothers had a little bit of a problem. They ran out of money, and they did not have their train completed. And so J.P. Morgan, just a swell guy, always willing to help out, comes in and funds them, but doesn't give them all the funding that they need. It gets halfway through this thing and then stops the funding. And, of course, they go under. They go under because they set up this big production line of building this railway. I mean, to build a railway where they was sufficient to get this iron ore out, this is a big operation. And so anyway, J.P. Morgan cuts them off. They go bankrupt. J.P. Morgan comes in and establishes Reserve Mining, takes everything they did, basically. And I've had that happen to me. The propulsion system that you can see the IEEE publication on in my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, was stolen by venture capitalists in Los Angeles and handed over to the aerospace industry, where they produce that as a product. And that's a story. I've talked about that before, so I'm not going to go into that now. But typically, venture capitalists are the most ruthless, corrupt people. And to see them go bankrupt is, you know, what would you call political justice at its best. But the real issue with venture capitalism investment is that what they do is they, and this is what they wanted to do with me, and I told them, no, I'm not playing this game. It's really stupid.
But they, what they would do is they'd come in and they'd invest into a company that maybe had a potential product. Maybe it didn't. Maybe they knew it didn't. But at any rate, the idea was that you would invest in this company and you would set up workers, you would just have employees, you would have secretaries, you'd have the all of the major management staff, the CFOs, the CEOs, the financial directors, and then you have the board, of which the investors would be on the board. Of course, they wanted to watch their investment, which would be understandable. But then what they do is they set up a series of investments. And I actually had this happen to my archery business back in the 90s. I was running an archery business, was building the first carbon fiber bows. And I had an investment group that invested, and it was supposed to come in two stages. The first investment came, and it was everything was developed. And then the second investment was to come along and finish the marketing and everything else that had to happen to market these amazing carbon fiber bows that I was building. And that was back in the early days where you had to have high pressure and high temperature for the production of these carbon fiber bows, archery bows. And so at any rate, they did not give me the second half of the funding, and the business went under. And of course, the reason they were doing that was they were hanging out to buy the business pennies on the dollars, which they never got. But that's what venture capitalists do. They're thieves, they're sharks. And they're not there for the benefit of the company. They're there to destroy. Their whole goal is to destroy the company. So what they do is they put this overbearing amount of overhead, financial overhead on the company. And then when the company fails, their goal is then to buy the technology. And so they get it for free. But, you know, they made an investment. They employed some people for a little bit of time, but they know that ultimately when they turn around and sell that technology to the government or somebody else, some high-end users like aerospace or like the airline industry or something, fighter plane technology or whatever it was, that they would make a lot more money than what they lost. So that's venture capitalism, and it's a cutthroat business, and they are constantly sucking new people into this mill that they run to basically steal people's ideas. So like I say, when the venture capitalist bank fails, it is like, okay, good riddance. It's like getting rid of the cockroaches in the kitchen. They're really, you know, they're evil people. Believe me. And just to give you a little taste of what was going on when I was in Los Angeles, this was in around 1982, I would put it in that time frame, 1982-83. I was going to the aerospace conferences. I was giving talks. I was giving invited talks at Los Alamos. I was at the aerospace air show in San Diego, other places where I was promoting my science and propulsion systems and things like that. And I was in a meeting with scientists who were vetting my science. They were very heeled physicists. One of the guys had invented the stepper motor, a very important thing which you use every time you have a printer or all kinds of motors that are in automobiles. It's a stepper motor. That's what they're called. This guy invented them. He had the patent on them. So he was vetting my scientific research, and I passed. I mean, we had a good conversation. He understood what I was doing. So he gave the okay to the venture capital group to invest in my project. And so anyway, we're sitting there, and this scientist, they're talking back and forth, and it turns out that, I'll just say Francis, was the venture capital guy, and he was involved in the Iran-Contra drug smuggling for arms thing that was going on. He was actually involved in that. And the scientists, they were talking about it at the lunch meeting. They were talking about how they had twin-engine planes that the CIA came in and sold insurance policies to these people, these doctors and dentists that had very capable twin-engine airplanes that had long range, and they would insure them, and then they would steal the plane and replace it, so now they had two planes with the same VIN number, the exact same airplane. So when they set up flight records, they would fly one plane out of the country, and they would go out over the Pacific Ocean from L.A., and they would then fly down to Nicaragua, where they dropped off the arms, picked up the cocaine, and brought it back to the highly lucrative Hollywood market for cocaine. That's what they were talking about at this meeting. And this physicist says, Francis, why don't you let these poor people alone?
This is what the conversation was, the background conversation in a meeting where I was talking about this venture capital group investing in my aerospace company. So anyway, this was common knowledge in Los Angeles, and these are the families that run the world. They're in corruption, they're in human trafficking, they're in drug trafficking, the CIA, and this is all mixed together. All mixed together. So anyway, just a little side note there. Also, just a quick notice here. In many foreign countries, the news is that the train derailment in Ohio was caused by the Russians. And people repeat this like that's the real story. And even I'm sure in the United States, there are people going around that listen to the news, oh, Russia caused the train derailment in Ohio, which is absurd. It's just absolutely absurd, knowing what everybody knows about that train derailment, that the sensors did not work, that would report the wheel that was bad, that was dragging and caused the derailment. None of the sensors were reporting, and it was like a case of Jeffrey Epstein being killed in a prison cell when all the cameras didn't work and the guards were sleeping and the main guard was asleep. And then he just disappears. And nobody knows anything about it. The same thing. Okay, so anyway, another topic here along the same what's going on in the world. Apparently, April 23rd, there's going to be some kind of national test where everybody's supposed to get a notification from the federal government. It's a test of the emergency broadcast system. And it used to be it would go on televisions, or it would go on, the old black and white or old color televisions, tube televisions, before they had censoring chips and cameras in phones and everything like that. And so anyway, what you're supposed to do is touch it and verify that you received the message. But when you touch your screen, it's going to take a picture of you and send this into the database. So what people are suggesting is on the 23rd of April, just turn your phone off. So millions and millions and millions of people will simply turn their phone off, which probably isn't a bad idea. You know, it'd be fun to, a good idea, I would think, to have people like a business day where you say, okay, on this day, you can call me. Other than that, unless you're dying in the street and, bleeding to death, don't call me. So anyway, but the strange thing is that the 23rd is a prime number. And so anyway, they plan their events on prime number days. So I'm not sure if that's a signal that something's going to happen, because they also tend to plan real events on top of staged practices, like 9/11 was, like other things have been. And so they piggyback a real event onto a planned test. Anyway, I don't know what's going on. I don't want to join the conspiracy theory world of trying to predict things, but it just seems a bit strange and, of course, invasive, to say the least.
Okay, but I'm going to jump back to the venture capital topic that I kind of got diverted here a little bit. But basically, venture capital investments, what they do is, okay, they what a company does to prepare for venture capital or investment is, and especially if they're a development company and they had a product, you know, it's the better mousetrap thing. What they do is they staff it with all of these executives, CEO, CFO, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and high-paying jobs. And so they have engineers, they have top-flight engineers, etc. And they get all this together, and of course, they've got an idea on paper, or maybe they've developed to a certain point. And but they, what the venture capital group looks for is the management staff, because these are all business people. They don't understand engineering. They don't understand science. They don't understand what it takes to run a project. But if they look and see all of these glorious people filling out the CFO and the CEO and the high-ranking management people, they in basically structure a company as if it were a full-blown, successful company like General Electric or, you know, whatever, some major company. And then they look at that, and they don't really look at the product. So I would say 98% of the companies that are funded through venture capital have a product that has no chance of success at all. But they have this amazing management staff. And so that's what the venture capitalists base their investment on. And I've seen, I don't know how many of these, hundreds, maybe thousands, of companies that fail because that is the model. That's the venture capital model. And they can't figure out why their investments fail. And so I went to venture capitalists, and they will tell you. They say, most of our investments fail, so the ones that succeed, we really have to make all this money off of because they're the only ones that succeed, and otherwise we would lose all our money. So what they do is they take a company that's successful, and they have to milk it till the cows come home to cover their losses for all of the bad investments that they made. So here's this poor company that's out there succeeding, paying for all the bad decisions of the venture capital group. So that's just no wonder that this whole system has collapsed. And then you have economy where if you come back to basic economy as we are at right now, the lean, mean companies can survive. The lean, mean companies will survive if they're managed properly because they're not set up with all of this massive overhead. And so, you know, like some companies, when things go bad, they fire the employees. A smart company, when things go bad, you fire the management. And you get down to where just the employees who know their job, they can continue doing them, will move forward. They produce a product. They can reduce the price of the product to match market demand or lack of demand, I should say. And those companies can succeed. But in the venture capital world, they've got this overbloated management system. They hire, you know, all of the downline, every manager to protect his bureaucratic position, then hire staff. And that staff then, that's just all of these people who are sending emails back and forth and having meetings and discussing things and flying around the country, having other meetings and coming back with information that really does not do anything for the company. It does not do anything for the bottom line, but they spend all this money. So what does so you have a product selling a widget, some product, and that has to support all of this, and it's simply not enough money to make it. So these companies fail at a very high rate. And the venture capital model never did work. The only reason the venture capital model worked was because of government money into aerospace and things like that. So the venture capital group would invest into a company, and the government would come along and then buy these products at exorbitant fees, exorbitant prices, and that's where venture capital would work because the government was supporting this bogus system. And so when venture capital has to go out into the real world, it's a failure. It cannot succeed. Its inherent model is a model for disaster. So getting back to the SVB bank failures, in the time when things are leaner, venture capital, in the time when the government is pouring huge amounts of money into only one thing, like the infrastructure build, which puts money into people's pockets. It's not meant to build infrastructure. That's a phony name. It's a way for rich people and the Democratic side. And that's what elections are all about. It's all about the money and whose buddies get the money. Same way on the Republican side. It's all the same thing. Whose buddies get the money from the government? That's what it's all about. So anyway, venture capital is a failure. By inherent design, it is a failure. It had no possibility of success. And so anyway, just to get back to a few things here. And by the way, I just want to reaffirm this idea, the protection racket, you know, for the insurance companies, for global climate change, for COVID, for mass shootings. These are all the old protection racket at work, at its, you know, at the government involvement, and a lot of private industries also make a lot of money off of this. Okay, so just a quick couple notes here. I get requests from people about the MR5 whole house water filter. And of course, to install this, you need a plumber. And we will help your plumber install them, but we don't get involved in hiring the plumber because a lot of people have a plumber because you own a house. You probably have had plumbing. The issue is that local zoning laws, local regulations, etc., and local plumbing codes are all different. And so that's why a local plumber will know all of those things. But we will be on the phone with your plumber, explain things. We can send them the instructions before they're there so they know what to bring with them, etc. But just to clarify that, and local plumbing rates are different. So before you buy, check it out. You know, that's something you can do. See how much they would quote you, and they should come in at near their quote for installing those. And then a lot of times the plumbers, once they install one, they go, oh, this was easy, and they start installing them for other people. Anyway, just a reminder, go to my webpages, jmccwaterfilters.com. The MR5 water system with the best deal is on sale. Also, my books on my webpage, the grow towers, something that everybody should have, the ability to grow vegetables, etc., in your own house. The webpage is jmccsci.com, the water filter webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, and I'm out of time again. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.